From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, J.J. Green, national correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA, and our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. As the presidential election here in the United States heats up, President Trump's path to re-election is looking a bit more complicated. We'll have the latest on the trade and tariff spat between the U.S. and China. Meantime, the president and other leaders from the Group of Seven pretty much agree to disagree on several big issues. One of them is climate change. This as fires continue to burn in the Amazon. And Britain's Brexit battle, Prime Minister Boris Johnson plans to suspend Parliament so he can deal with leaving the European Union. Well, welcome to both of you, Kimberly and JJ. Let's start with this 2020 election, which is heating up. You know, the incumbent President Donald Trump is quite popular with Republicans, of course, deeply unpopular with everybody else, I think it's fair to say. He has also tied his fortunes pretty closely to the economy. He's always talking about the stock market and so forth.
When it goes up.
Both of those things, Kimberly, are now looking actually kind of wobbly, and there's growing talk of a recession. What do you think?
Well, the recession talk is definitely getting louder, especially when you look at the global economy. You have Germany looking like it's heading into a recession if it's already not in one. Manufacturing is slowing down in the United States. And, of course, the trade war is weighing on everything. And there are real concerns that the ongoing trade war that President Trump started and continues to escalate with China is going to be a further drag on the economy. You have retailers really raising the alarm about the fact that these taxes are going to be passed on to consumers. And right now, consumer spending, it is pretty much the only thing keeping economic growth going in the United States. Consumer spending is about 70% of the economy. Middle-class consumers in particular are still spending, but once those tariffs kick in, there's real concern they may slow down.
There was a report, in fact, by the investment bank J.P. Morgan not too long ago that said the impact on the average American household, about $1,000 in 2020. Now, for a lot of people, $1,000 is nothing, but for most Americans, that's actually a fair amount of money.
Right, and that's just for this latest round of tariffs that's going to be kicking in starting on September 1st, and then the later list on December the 15th. And one of the key demographics that's being harmed by this trade war, I mean, sure, a lot of this newest round is going to affect sort of retail products, you know, toys, clothing, shoes, things like that, but farmers, sort of the bedrock of President Trump's support in a lot of these key states like Iowa, they are really feeling the pinch. The retaliatory tariffs from China on U.S. agricultural products are depressing already low crop prices, and it's really hurting farm country. And some of that is starting to bubble up in the narrative about Republican support, especially in the Midwest.
And yet the polls of these farmers show, yes, they're nervous, but by and large, do they still continue to back President Trump?
By and large, they do in the polling, but that seems to be, at least based on what I've seen thus far and heard from people to whom I've spoken, it's more about not liking any of the Democratic candidates thus far, as opposed to feeling like President Trump is actually helping them. But as their bottom lines continue to shrink, we'll see if that continues.
Now, the timing and severity of recession, of course, always pretty much impossible to predict. So we'll just keep an eye on the data as it comes out. Now, my old friend JJ, foreign policy, national security, that is your turf. Now, one of the primary responsibilities of any president, of course, perhaps the primary responsibility, is to keep Americans safe. So we're now going on 3 years into this Trump administration. Mm-hmm. And the question is, are we safer than we were 3 years ago?
Well, if you want to talk about kinetic threats, no. And I don't think that would be any different under any president, just looking at the way that threats have evolved. But looking into what you guys were just talking about, the economy and then to security, one of the things I've always heard is the quickest way to get an American or a consumer's attention is through the pocketbook. The second way is through security. The interesting thing that I've learned in the last few years, these 3 years you're talking about, is the confluence of these two concerns right now is upon us. You know, economy is a huge tenet when it comes to national security. And the economic situation is not good because if you can't make that work, then you can't pay for the things you need for security. And whether or not we are well-funded or not in this country to deal with security, it's at an all-time high in terms of a problem, in terms of the problematic nature of it. More terror groups, more tools for them to use, more espionage, more spies, more ways for them to get at you. Our security situation is worse now than it was before he got into office. And considering where we are economically and the path we're on, it just doesn't look like it's getting any better anytime soon.
So in terms of this 2020 narrative, you say that we are not safer, but is that a perception? You see that, but is that a perception that American voters sense at this point?
Well, look at this way. American voters now realize that there was something funny that happened in the 2016 election. They realized that the people that sit down at 1600, the people at Langley, the people over at the Pentagon, were not able to stop that.
By Langley, for our foreign viewers, when you say Langley, you mean CIA.
CIA, okay. White House, and the Pentagon were not able to stop that, whatever it was that happened. The Justice Department says it was a direct interference from Russian-sponsored actors. We now know that's been a blueprint for others. Others are going out and trying to emulate that from other nation states and other actors. So, no, Americans recognize that the whole security situation is different now, that we can't be protected from everything by the people who sit in those places. A lot of it is on us. But at the same time, I think voters are starting to realize that they have to make some serious choices when it comes to who continues to run this country, whether it's the president, Congress, or whoever, and they have to be very careful about how they make those choices. The question is now people are so beleaguered by this whole mess that we've had in the last three years or so that many of them are thinking, well, are there really any options? Or is there any real way we can change the security dynamic, considering what happened in 2016 and the reluctance on the Hill of some to deal with election security issues?
Now, talking about on this 2020 theme, Kimberly, you said something interesting before, that sort of these farmers still like President Trump, simply not because they're in love with him necessarily, but they see these Democratic candidates as perhaps even more undesirable. At this point, yeah, it's probably fair to say that the leading Democratic contenders, no surprise, former Vice President Joe Biden and Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, are the leaders in terms of their insistence that they can make things safer, both economically and from a foreign policy standpoint. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's important to highlight something that JJ said about the link between security and the economy. If we think back to the start of the trade war, President Trump has consistently made this argument that the reason we need to exact more tariffs on China is because they are threatening our national security by their economic policies, by the way that they force American companies to give up some of their technology. So I think it's going to be increasingly difficult throughout the 2020 campaign to separate these topics of security and the economy. And when it comes to Russia, you know, this is one of the reasons that President Trump has been able to maintain his support among his Republican base, is because many of them just do not believe that narrative, that Russia meaningfully interfered in the 2016 election. Some of that has to do with media that's being consumed differently in different parts of the country. And the other part is this sense that those of us here on the East Coast, the journalism and media elites, aren't necessarily connected and are perpetuating a narrative that many people just don't relate to. But when you come back to the Democratic candidates, this is really the big battle for them, to appeal to voters in parts of the country that Trump won that don't care about the Russia dynamic. They do care about whether or not their drug prices are going up, whether or not they can pay their student loans. And so you find these Democratic candidates trying very hard to stay out of sort of the conversations that obsess us here in Washington and really get to those voters. And I think agriculture, when we're talking about the farmers and the tariffs and the trade war and the fact that despite multiple rounds of tariffs at this point, American businesses are not bringing those jobs back to the United States. They're maybe shifting their supply chains elsewhere in a few cases. But the promises that President Trump made about what this trade war would accomplish, that China would pay for the tariffs, that American consumers wouldn't feel it, that it would bring jobs back to the United States. Thus far, those things have not happened. And we'll see if that's enough to sort of pull away some of that strong Republican base from him.
And the president often says that a lot of these jobs, China is now, companies are leaving China. The implication is that it reflects his success in these policies, but a lot of companies are leaving China, not necessarily because of this trade and tariff war, but because costs in China are too high. They're going to places like Vietnam and the Philippines where it's cheaper.
Just a really quick point. Another piece of this narrative we should possibly focus on here is the espionage part of this. The Chinese government has said by 2025 they want to be number one in the world in everything. And so what they've done is either gone out and tried to buy, steal, or recreate, reverse engineer everything that the U.S. and other world leaders in technology have done, have created. And what they want to do is to use that to become the dominant power in the world by 2025. It's a part of their new initiative. It's not the first time that they've done this, but the problem that we face right now as we try to dig ourselves out of the situation that we're in, the global situation, not just the global political view, but the global security view. And, you know, to some degree, people look at us a little differently now from a societal point of view because of this fighting that's always on public display. They recognize, China recognizes this, Russia recognizes this, Iran, North Korea, many other countries, and even our allies. They spy on us too. And they realize there are ways to take advantage of the U.S., and all of them realize that. And the real problem that we're facing right now, according to the folks from the FBI that I've spoken to, is this unprecedented wave of espionage that's taking place right under our noses, that's stealing everything from us, taking everything from us, including our will to agree, our interest in agreeing and working together to get beyond it. They've undermined our ability to some degree to come together.
All right, on that pleasant note, let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now, back to our panel. Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace. J.J. Green, national correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. And our moderator, Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. A week ago, leaders from the Group of Seven met in France. President Trump said things went quite well, but it looks like he and the other leaders pretty much agreed to disagree on pretty much everything from Iran to trade and climate change. Kimberly, how did it look to you?
Exactly as you say. I mean, French President Emmanuel Macron spent pretty much the entire time trying to alleviate the Trump effect at the G7. He decided not to even issue a communique at the end, which is a normal procedure of sort of a statement of the unified group. He knew that wasn't going to happen, didn't even want to bother it. Lots of focus, at least attempts to focus, on climate change, especially in light of the fires happening in Brazil. President Trump famously did not attend the climate change session. It's yet another example of sort of the strained relationship between President Trump and some of our traditional allies. And at the same time, you know, we have to keep in mind that much of Europe is focused not just on Trump as a person, but also the effect that the trade war between the U.S. and China, the world's two largest economies, are having on the global economy, because there are ripple effects that are being felt by the G7 nations. And then, of course, you have Brexit thrown in just for fun.
Well, we're going to get to Brexit in just a little bit. But, JJ, you were talking about this before the break, sort of these deepening divides, not only in the United States, where we're fighting all the time, but now we have this transatlantic rift, too, with this perception that the United States is disengaging from the rest of the world. A lot of people think that is a grave security risk when we're not as closely tied to our traditional allies as we always have been. And yet that is the trend that we're going in. And the G7 gave nothing to dispel the image that's where we're going.
You know, this isn't the first time, actually, that this has happened. World War I, it happened as well. There was this disengagement from what was going on in the world. The Wilson administration at that time wanted to focus inward. It later turned out to be a mistake as World War II rolled around. And as we sit here today, the seconds are ticking away. And there is a positive and a negative in that, from my perspective. The positive is this. Time is ticking away on the people who are causing essentially these issues, these problems, presenting these roadblocks, essentially pouring the oil in the ointment right now, and they're going to be gone at some point. The thing is, people, I would just suggest, need to realize that this kind of thing has happened before, and it's kind of passed away, and it's improved. The other part of the issue is time is of the essence. We have to get this done. And we can't just sit around and wait for these people to leave the scene. People have to become more engaged, more knowledgeable, more educated. And I bring that up to kind of harken back to what you were talking about with the fires in the Amazon. I saw some interesting images from NASA this week. There are more fires like that going on in Angola than there are in the Amazon. But we're not hearing about what's happening in Angola. We're hearing about the Amazon for obvious reasons, political reasons. But what I learned from it is people in both of those places are farmers, apparently, allegedly, setting fires as a matter of tradition. When we look at where our climate is and where we are in time, as time continues to tick away, we can no longer do this kind of thing without having an educated approach to it. We need to understand, they need to understand, the environment is under stress. And oxygen is important, okay? So, but again, education is the key to them learning better and doing better. And it's also key to the rest of us as well, as we look at all of these things taking place and we're not really doing anything about them.
Kimberly, you mentioned, of course, that there was a G7, there was a session on the environment and the climate. President Trump skipped that meeting, and he was asked about it at a news conference at the end of the G7, and he said, "Well, I'm an environmentalist," and then he went on to talk about wealth tied up in oil and gas projects. In other words, just kind of skipped the issue entirely and said, "Well, we have all this wealth; we're not going to squander it." But the fact is, you know, his administration, I think we have to admit some facts here, has really rolled back a lot of regulations in terms of the air and the water. These are facts. How does President Trump square that with his comments that, well, I'm an environmentalist, I like clean air and clean water? These seem to be two very different things in motion here.
Well, this is pretty consistent for President Trump. He often says things that are very different than the actions that his administration pursues. Just this week, we had the EPA under the Trump administration issue new proposed rules to roll back regulations on methane emissions from the oil and gas industry, methane being a greenhouse gas that can trap something like 80 times more heat in the atmosphere than CO2, another greenhouse gas that Trump recently rolled back the regulations in terms of restricting those emissions. There's very clear influence of the oil and gas industry in Trump administration and spoken desire to lessen regulations on those industries and let them regulate themselves. So obviously there will be legal challenges for that moving forward. But going back to JJ's point about the fires in the Amazon and sort of the need to change behaviors, you had not only indigenous communities and farmers who do sort of traditional burning in Brazil that helped spark these, but also concrete actions by Brazil's leader, Jair Bolsonaro, to allow more of the industrial scale cattle industry and leather industries to do large amounts of clear cutting and burning to promote that industry. You even have some American companies now stepping in saying they won't source leather from Brazil until there are actions taken to address this. At the G7, there was an offer to send something like $20 million to Brazil to help fight these fires. Jair Bolsonaro was very offended by that, said he didn't want it. He is accepting aid from Chile.
And he wanted an apology, in fact.
He is accepting aid from Chile, and there's a meeting coming up in September, supposedly, of the other South American countries in the Amazon rainforest basin to try to come up with solutions. So I think politics is playing such a role in how we deal with climate change on a global scale.
Here's one thing talking about methane and the rollback on these rules. Here is something that from the New York Times talking about this, and they say the move to rescind environmental rules governing emissions of methane, a powerful greenhouse gas, brings to 84 the total number of environmental rules that the Trump administration has worked to repeal.
Not to mention pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord.
84, yes.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's no question that President Trump gets a lot of support from the oil and gas industry. Lobbying money flowed his way in 2016, and the number of sort of appointees from these industries that he has stocked his government with, I think, is probably the answer.
And I wonder why we haven't seen more of a concerted effort by people who recognize this and understand this to call it out, one, and to essentially put those companies and people on notice that you can't do this. You can't essentially create this platform that's essentially going to undermine our future for some money right now. I just haven't seen a larger outcry. I mean, I don't know why.
Got just a couple of minutes left here, and we did want to talk briefly about something that Kimberly, you mentioned before, and that is Brexit. Of course, the new Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, says that Parliament, Britain, of course, one of the world's longest, most revered democracies, says he wants to suspend Parliament, if you can believe it, until mid-October while he tries to achieve Brexit, of course, which is taking the United Kingdom out of the European Union. There was this referendum back in 2016 to do that. It's been a big mess since. Two prime ministers have come and gone. Nothing has happened. Now Johnson says, we're going to suspend Parliament so I can have my way here. A democracy like Britain suspending Parliament? Who wants to talk about that?
Well, it's been interesting because those two prime ministers came and went because despite the fact that Britain's voted for Brexit, there hasn't been a consensus about how to do it. The European Union is offering one deal. Britain doesn't like it. And the EU leadership has said they are pretty much done negotiating over this. Boris Johnson suspended Parliament at the approval of Her Majesty the Queen of England in order to sort of condense the amount of time for debate after he gets whatever deal he negotiates, if he gets a new deal from the EU, so that way it's a harder choice for the British Parliament and in a narrow window, because he said, come deal or not, we are leaving the EU in October. And so by condensing that window for debate, he's forcing them to make a decision on a deal that they may or may not like.
Now, JJ, there have been reports by British investment firms and even England's central bank, the Bank of England, saying that this is all quite messy. It could result in economic chaos, food shortages, on and on and on. What are the security implications of kind of a Brexit gone bad?
They're gigantic. And if you look at Boris Johnson's history and his connections with some of those that would like to see things go bad in the UK, i.e. Russian oligarchs and others, then you might have an inkling, and I don't want to be too dark about this, but you might have an inkling as to what's taking place right now. I mean, the whole Brexit thing came from a guy named Neil Farage. And, you know, we know a little bit more about what his motivations were. Boris Johnson is essentially the cleanup hitter right now. He's cleaning it all up, supposedly. But we have to think about the origin of all of this. Even after this deadline passes, regardless of what happens, whether he gets what he wants or not, there's still going to be this problem of outside influence in the UK, and it's gradual shifting and changing from the UK people have known for centuries to this modern UK that's dominated by the influence of foreigners.
And the other thing, by the way, since you're mentioning Farage, I mean, Farage and Boris Johnson, of course, both close to President Trump, quite influential. And the thought that I had is, gosh, if Boris Johnson can suspend Parliament, I wonder, just to play the devil's advocate, is that kind of an interesting thought that maybe the president might have with any issues that he might have with Congress? I'm just throwing that out there.
Let's not put that into the universe.
Exactly. I agree with Kimberly on that one.
We'll have to leave it right there. Our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Kimberly Adams. She's the correspondent for Marketplace, and J.J. Green. He's national correspondent for WTOP Radio. This program was produced by Kim Lewis, our engineer Justin Thwaites. And I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports and USA Today. Thanks for joining us.